It is 4 p.m. on a Sunday, and you know the exact feeling I'm talking about here.
Oh, yeah. The Sunday scaries.
The Sunday scaries. You had this weekend where maybe you actually felt human for a change. You went to a service or you hung out with family, felt connected, maybe even a little spiritual.
Right.
And then you look at the clock, you see the sun starting to go down, and you feel this actual physical gear shift in your chest.
Yeah, it's like the armor is going back on.
Exactly. It feels like you have to completely turn off the soul part of your brain, the part that cares about beauty and kindness and connection, and you have to turn on the cog part.
The part that just grinds.
Yeah, the grinder. It's like you're stepping out of the sacred and stepping into the secular. And honestly, it is exhausting.
It's totally exhausting
Yeah.
because it makes you feel like you are living two completely different lives.
Two totally different lives, and you're just jumping back and forth.
That fragmentation, that's what we call the Sunday Monday gap. And it's not, I mean, it's not just a mood or a temporary feeling. It's actually a worldview
Your
problem.
worldview problem.
Yeah. It's this deeply ingrained idea that we have two buckets. We've got the God bucket or the meaningful bucket, and then way over there we have the work bucket.
And the work bucket is basically just there to pay for the meaningful bucket.
Right, which is an incredibly depressing way to spend 40 to 60 hours a week.
It really is. But that actually brings us to the stack of research we are unpacking today for this deep dive. We are looking at some fascinating materials from Cities Project Global.
Excellent stuff.
Really eye-opening. Specifically, we're focusing heavily on their book, The Intersection of Faith, Work, and Life.
Right.
And their argument right out of the gate is pretty aggressive.
Right.
They claim this whole Sunday Monday gap isn't just making you visible, they say it's an actual lie.
It's a fundamental philosophical error.
Yeah.
That's what they're arguing. And what I really love about our focus today is that we are zooming in on one specific chapter that offers a completely different mental model for the world.
A total paradigm shift.
Exactly. They do not see the world as a battlefield where you just have to survive the trenches until the weekend arrives.
Thank goodness.
And they don't see it as a marketplace either, where you just sell your soul for a paycheck.
No, the image that really stuck with me, the core of this whole thing, is they argue that God created the world to be one giant complex orchestra.
It is a beautiful image, but before we can really appreciate the music of that orchestra, we have to figure out why we went deaf to it in the first place.
Right. How did we get here?
Exactly. Why do we feel this split? Why does an accountant in Chicago assume they're just pushing numbers while they look at a missionary in a jungle and think, oh, that person is doing the holy work?
We have to blame the Greeks for this, don't we?
Oh, we always blame the Greeks. We really
We
do.
do.
We have to look all the way back to Plato and the early Greek philosophers. See, their view of reality was deeply dualistic.
It's dualistic. Okay, break that down for us.
Sure, they separated literally everything into two distinct tiers. You have the spiritual tier, so ideas, the soul, the mind. That was considered the ultimate good. It was pure and eternal.
Okay.
But then you had the material tier, the physical body, the earth, manual labor, money. And
Right.
that was considered inherently lesser, sometimes even bad, but definitely lower class.
So basically, if you're sitting around under a tree thinking big philosophical thoughts, you are winning at life.
Exactly.
But if you're digging a ditch or, building a table, you're losing.
You're at the bottom of the hierarchy. And the real tragedy is how this Greek thinking totally infiltrated religious history over the centuries. It created this massive religious class system.
The professionals versus the amateurs.
Precisely. The religious professional, the monk, the priest, the pastor, they sat at the very top of the pyramid because their entire life dealt with spiritual things.
While everyone else was just at the bottom, doing the dirty work to support the spiritual guys at the top, which is incredibly demoralizing when you think about it.
It is.
Because it tells the vast majority of the population, the people listening to this right now, that their daily contribution, whether they're writing code or fixing cars or changing diapers, is strictly second class. It's just maintenance.
But the Cities Project Global material pushes back on this so hard. They argue this dualism is absolutely not the Hebraic or biblical worldview.
Not at all.
The ancient Hebrew view was completely integrated. There was no sacred box over here and a secular box over there. It was all one thing.
And to really understand that, you have to wrap your head around one specific Hebrew word. It completely changes the game. Avoda.
Avoda.
Yes. I found this part so fascinating because in English, we are very precise with our categories. Work is work, worship is worship, service is service. We do not mix those up.
Right. But in Hebrew, that single word, avoda, is used for all three of those concepts interchangeably.
This blows my mind.
It really reframes everything. It appears right at the beginning in Genesis chapter 2. Adam is put in the garden to work it. The word used there is avoda.
Okay.
But then much later in the text, when it's describing the priests working in the holy temple offering sacrifices, that exact same word is used. It's avoda.
So to the ancient Hebrew mind, digging in the dirt in a garden and praying in a sacred temple were described by the exact same verb.
The root is identical. And the implication of that is just massive for us today. It means that the physical labor itself is the worship, provided the intent of the worker is right.
It suggests that God actually cares just as much about good plumbing as he does about good preaching.
That is a very bold claim.
It is, because I'll tell you, if my toilet is overflowing into my hallway, I definitely care way more about the plumbing than the preaching in that exact moment.
I think we all would. But it shifts the entire metric of what we consider holy, doesn't it?
It really does. It's not about what job title you have on your business card.
Yeah.
It's entirely about how you do the job you have.
And why you do it. Which leads us perfectly to the other key Hebrew term the book unpacks, shalom. Now, normally we translate shalom as peace.
Which in modern English we usually interpret as just quiet. Like, please, I just want some peace and quiet. Stop bothering me.
Right, an absence of conflict. But the actual Hebrew definition is so much thicker than that. It means wholeness. It means a state of absolute completeness.
The authors use that great metaphor of a stone wall.
Yes, the wall. If a stone wall has missing bricks, or if the mortar is crumbling and there are cracks everywhere, that wall lacks shalom. It is not whole. It's compromised.
So applying that to work, if I'm an IT guy and I fix a software bug that's been crashing people's computers and causing them stress, I'm not just doing IT.
There you go.
I'm repairing a crack in the wall. I am actually restoring order to a chaotic system.
Exactly. You become an active agent of restoration. Whether you're a dentist fixing a cavity or a corporate lawyer fixing a broken contract, you are actively pushing back against the entropy of the world. You are bringing shalom.
Okay, so that sets our stage perfectly. We are not just cogs grinding out a paycheck until we die. We are restorers. But this is where we really need to dive into the core of the research today.
The main event.
Yes, the chapter literally titled, God Created the World to Be One Beautiful Orchestra.
This is the anchor for everything Cities Project Global is trying to communicate here. Because even if you start to believe your work matters, It is so incredibly easy to feel lost in the noise of the modern world.
Well, let's talk about that noise. Because the book opens this section by taking a pretty sharp swing at what they call hustle culture.
Oh, the LinkedIn hustle.
Yes, we see this every single time we open a social app. 10 morning habits of Elon Musk, how to be the next Steve Jobs, crush your competitors.
The underlying message of all that content is always the same. If you want your life to matter, you have to be the soloist. You have to be the front man holding the microphone.
Right, you have to be the star.
And the source material calls that exact mindset cacophony. Think about it conceptually for a second. If you were sitting in a massive symphony orchestra and the tuba player suddenly decides he wants to be the lead violin because the violin is getting all the melody and the glory. What happens to the music?
It's an absolute disaster. You completely lose the rhythm, you drop the bass foundation, and you just have this tuba trying to screech out high notes it was never built for. It's physically painful to listen to.
But that is an exact picture of the modern workplace.
Everyone is trying to play the soloist instrument because that is what our culture applauds.
Right. But the text asks us to zoom out and imagine an orchestra made up of 8 billion people. And in this incredibly complex orchestra, there is a divine conductor.
And the conductor is the one handing out the sheet music.
Exactly. And here is the crucial part. The sheet music is completely unique to every single player. Some people are handed the sheet music for architecture. Some get the sheet music for raising toddlers. Some get public policy. Some get sanitation engineering.
It's the ultimate stay in your lane argument, but in the best, most freeing way possible.
Play your instrument. That's the mandate. The person reading the treble clef does not need to understand the bass clef to know it's necessary for the song.
Right. The creative director at a company might look across the hall at the accountant and think, wow, how boring, looking at spreadsheets all day long.
But without the financial structure that the accountant provides, the creative department goes bankrupt in a month.
The melody absolutely requires the rhythm.
And here is the massive psychological release that the source points out. If you actually accept this orchestra metaphor, you can finally stop looking at your neighbor.
You stop checking the influencer on Instagram to see if you're behind in life.
Yes. You realize, oh, they're playing the trumpet, I'm playing the cello. Why in the world would I try to play their notes on my instrument?
It completely kills the comparison trap. Because success isn't defined by getting the audience to clap for your solo. Success is defined by keeping your eyes locked on the conductor and hitting your specific cue when the baton points at you.
That is where the piece, the shalom, actually comes from. You don't have to carry the weight of the whole symphony on your shoulders. You just have to play your bar of music well.
I love that. But I do have to push back just a little bit here because I think this is exactly where people start to get cynical.
Okay, let's hear it.
It is very easy to say, hey, just play your part if your part is the CEO or if you're the first chair violin. But what if your part feels, I don't know, insignificant?
Like you're in the very back row.
Yeah. You're in the back row playing the triangle and you only get to hit it once every 40 measures.
The small part anxiety. Does my work actually matter if nobody is watching me do it?
Exactly. I mean, we all want to believe we are building a grand cathedral, but on a Tuesday afternoon, it usually feels like we're just sweeping the floor.
It's a very real tension. And the source addresses this beautifully by bringing in a story from J.R.R. Tolkien, the author of Lord of the Rings.
I had never read this story before this deep dive, and man, it hit me way harder than I expected.
It is a haunting little story. It's called Leif by Nigel. So there is this painter named Nigel. He is not particularly famous, not super successful, but he has this vivid vision in his head of a massive, perfect, glorious tree, and he wants to paint this tree. It is his life's obsession.
But real life just keeps getting in the way.
Right. It's the constant interruption of the mundane. His neighbors get sick and he has to go help them. His roof springs a leak. He gets bogged down in administrative town
Up on
duties.
the Monday stuff.
Exactly. He is constantly being pulled away from his canvas to deal with real life. So by the time he reaches the end of his life and dies, he looks at his canvas and he hasn't painted the magnificent tree. He has only managed to paint one single tiny leaf.
Which, by every modern standard we have, is a total failure. He wasted his potential.
In this life, yes, it looks like a tragedy. But the story continues into the afterlife, what Tolkien calls the true reality. Nigel is traveling through this new country, and he sees something out in the distance, and he stops dead in his tracks.
It's the tree.
It is his tree, the exact one he tried to paint. It is there, it's completely finished, and it's absolutely real. And when he walks up to it and looks closely, he sees that the one little leaf he managed to paint back on Earth is physically part of it.
It wasn't just a copy of a leaf, it was a seed.
Yes. That is such a powerful reframing. Tim Keller provides some brilliant commentary on this in the source material we're looking at. He argues that our work here on Earth, even the really small stuff, even the stuff we leave unfinished when we die, is leaf work.
Leaf work, I love that term.
You might not ever see the whole tree in your lifetime. You might just be responsible for one leaf, one single project, one mentored relationship, one hidden act of integrity at the office.
But that leaf is actually attached to something eternal.
It's part of the permanent furniture of reality. Nothing is wasted.
So the midnight diaper change, the really difficult email you had to draft, the honest tax return, if it's done as avoda, as worship, it actually projects forward into the future.
It does. And this connects right back to what theologians call the cultural mandate in Genesis 1. Humans were commanded to fill the earth and subdue it.
Right.
The German word used to describe this in some texts is culture. We are commanded to cultivate, to actively build culture.
And the book points out that this mandate actually predates the command to preach or evangelize.
Yes, we are co-creators with God, building civilization, advancing science, creating art. Building the orchestra that is part of the original job description for humanity. We are literally writing the music as we play it.
Okay, I love the metaphors, trees and orchestras and leaves. But let's ground this for you listening, because it is one thing to talk about a divine orchestra in theory. It is a very different thing to apply this when your boss is yelling at you over a missed deadline.
Right, where does the rubber meet the road?
Exactly. And thankfully, the source gives us some incredible real-world case studies of people who actually made this mental shift.
The story of Marcelin is probably the most striking example they give of shifting from an exile mindset to an orchestra member mindset.
Oh, the Flower Man story. Walk us through that one.
Yeah, so Marcelin was this guy working for the United Nations in Côte d'Ivoire. Very high pressure, high stakes, diplomatic work. And initially, he felt like a total exile there.
He had that Greek dualism mindset we talked about.
Completely. He thought, I am a Christian, so I am basically operating in enemy territory here at the UN. I just need to keep my head down, do the secular job to get paid, and save all my real spiritual energy for church on Sunday.
He was hiding his sheet music.
He was. But then he happened to watch a short documentary about a man they called the Flower Man. This was a guy who voluntarily moved into a broken, gray, crime-ridden part of a city.
And what did he do? Did he start passing out tracts?
No. Instead of preaching on street corners, he just started fixing up his own house. He planted a vibrant garden in his front yard. He painted his walls bright colors. He started sweeping the trash off the street.
He just created beauty.
He brought shalom to one tiny square of a broken city. And the amazing thing was, it was contagious. His neighbors started fixing their broken fences. Crime in the area actually dropped because people suddenly started caring about the space they lived in.
It's like the broken windows theory, but in reverse, positive contagion.
Exactly. So Marcelin watches this video and he has an epiphany. He realizes, wait a minute, I can do that exact same thing at the United Nations.
His avoda wasn't to preach sermons to his UN coworkers. It was to bring excellence and beauty and order to his actual administrative work.
So practically speaking, he completely changed his posture at the office. He stopped treating his colleagues like they were the secular other.
Right.
And he just started serving them. He brought what theologians call common grace into his office. He decided to become the person who cared the absolute most about the quality of the reports, the efficiency of the meetings, and the personal well-being of his team members.
And the irony is, by stopping the internal pressure to preach, he actually gained way more influence with his peers.
Huge influence. They trusted him deeply. Yeah. Because when you play your instrument with that level of excellence and care, people stop and listen to the music. He literally changed the culture, the sound of his whole department.
There was another example in the text that really hit home for me, mostly because it deals with an industry that is notoriously cutthroat, real estate.
Yes. Joe and Jessica Dominguez.
Right. They were working in real estate in a booming market like Denver. And usually that world is all about the hustle. It's about maximizing commission, fighting for the luxury listings, eat or be eaten.
And meanwhile, right outside their office windows, you have a massive housing crisis happening. You have people who are terrified they can't afford a home, feeling pushed out, feeling marginalized and ashamed. The shalom of the city was completely broken when it came to housing.
So Joe and Jessica decided to run their agency based on a specific Hebrew concept called hesed.
Hesed. It is a beautiful word. It's often translated in English as loving kindness, but a much better, more accurate translation is sticky love.
Sticky love. I like that.
It implies a loyal, fierce, unbreakable commitment to someone else's good.
But how does sticky love actually work when you're trying to close a property deal and run a profitable business?
For them, it meant they prioritized maximizing dignity instead of just maximizing profit. They deliberately became experts in affordable housing programs. They spent hours walking lower-income clients through all the confusing paperwork that other agents totally ignored, because the commission check just wasn't high enough to bother.
They weren't just selling houses. They were restoring humanity.
They were repairing the wall. They looked at their city. They saw a massive crack, the shame of homelessness and the affordability crisis. And they used their highly specific professional skills to fill that crack. That is avoda in action.
And notice the key detail here. Neither Marcelin at the UN nor the Dominguez family in Denver quit their jobs to become full-time missionaries.
No, they didn't.
They actually dug deeper into their secular professions.
That is the whole secret. They became what the Hebrew text calls tzaddikim.
Okay. We are hitting all the great Hebrew vocabulary today. Tzaddikim. Let's define it.
It literally refers to the righteous ones. But historically, back in ancient Israel, the tzaddikim were the leaders and elders who sat at the city gates.
Because the gates were the center of everything back then, right? Commerce, law, all of it.
Exactly. The gate was the corporate boardroom. It was the city council. It was the judicial court. And the tzaddikim deliberately sat there to ensure that the entire community flourished. They looked out for the vulnerable. They made sure the economic scales were balanced and fair.
So translating that to today, the gate is the Zoom meeting. It's the Slack channel. It's the quarterly earnings call.
You've got it. If you are a middle manager fighting for a fair, livable wage for your team, you are a tzaddik sitting at the gate. If you're a public school teacher making sure a struggling student doesn't fall through the cracks, you are at the gate. If you're a software engineer refusing to write an algorithm that exploits user privacy, you are a tzaddik.
But here's the challenge with all of this, and to its credit, the city's Project Global Source is very honest about this reality.
It's not easy.
No, because the modern gate is full of people who do not believe in this divine orchestra at all. We spend 40 hours a week working alongside people who have totally different worldviews, different ethics, different goals. How in the world does collaboration work in that environment?
This is where that concept of common grace becomes the ultimate bridge. The source reminds us that God gives incredible gifts and talents to everyone, regardless of what they believe. The atheist architect has been given a profound gift for structural design.
Right.
The agnostic surgeon has been given a miraculous gift for healing the human body.
So we aren't just playing a solo in a padded room. We are sitting in the orchestra section right next to them.
Exactly. And the source suggests a really practical way to handle this. We need to change the fundamental question we ask our colleagues. Instead of asking them, hey, do you believe what I believe about God? We could just ask, do you care about what I care about?
Do you care about having clean water in this city? Do you care about building ethical supply chains? Do you care about designing a really beautiful, functional building?
Precisely. If we both deeply care about the music, the final outcome, we can play in perfect harmony together. We can collaborate fiercely for the common good. We do not have to agree on the theology to agree on the beauty of the result.
That is such a healthier, more constructive way to view the modern workplace. It totally moves us away from an us versus them mentality and shifts it to, let's build something beautiful together.
It comes right back to the orchestra. You might be sharing a music stand with someone who thinks the conductor is just a myth. But if you both read the sheet music and you both build a bridge that doesn't collapse under pressure, you are both contributing to the symphony of your city.
Man. So let's land the plane here. We've covered a lot of ground today. We started with the anxiety of the Sunday-Monday gap, we waded through the history of Greek dualism, and we arrived at this massive global orchestra.
We've moved from seeing our daily work as a necessary evil to seeing it as a voda, as an act of worship.
If there's one single thing I want you to take away from this deep dive, it's that your daily grind is not a waiting room for your real life.
No, it's not.
It isn't a distraction from your spiritual life.
It is your real life. The Excel spreadsheet, the parent-teacher meeting, the architectural blueprint, that is your sheet music. And the world actually needs your specific instrument.
You do not need to play Elon Musk's instrument. You don't need to play your pastor's instrument. You just need to watch the conductor.
That is where the piece is found. And remember Nagel and his painting. Even if your part feels incredibly small today, even if you feel like you only managed to get one tiny leaf done before you ran out of time, the tree is real. Your leaf matters.
So, as we wrap up, we always like to leave you with a final thought to mull over, something to explore on your own.
A provocative thought.
Exactly. We've talked so much about playing your notes and finding your instrument, but if you know anything about sheet music, you know that the notes are only half the song, the other half are the rests.
The deliberate silences.
Yes. The moments where the composer explicitly tells you not to play. What if bringing shalom to your workplace isn't just about the work you do, but the boundaries you keep? What if logging off at 5 p.m., refusing to answer emails on a Sunday, is actually a crucial part of your sheet music?
A rest that makes the melody stand out.
Exactly. If we never observe the rest, the orchestra just turns back into noise. So maybe your greatest act of avoda this week isn't just playing louder, but knowing exactly when to stay silent.
That's a great thought to end on.
Take a look at your calendar this week, find your instrument, play your notes, and honor the rests. This deep dive is just the beginning. The rest is up to you.
Thanks for listening.
See you next time.